In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This is a History Extra production. In the summer of 1940, the skies over Britain filled with the sound of engines and strafing. The Battle of Britain saw the RAF and the Luftwaffe go head-to-head in a fight for air dominance. And for the British pilots, the objective could not have been more critical: to protect their nation from the threat of Nazi invasion. But were the British really the plucky underdogs in this fight? And could Germany really have invaded if they had won the air battle over Britain? Well, in today's episode, we're exploring those questions in the first episode of a five-part series on the greatest battles of World War II with the military historian James Holland. James is the author of books including The Battle of Britain, 5 Months That Changed History, and also the co-founder of Chalk History Festival, of which we're a media partner. The festival runs from the 24th to the 30th of June this year, and you can find out more at chalkfestival.com. James was speaking to Rachel Dinning.
In 30 seconds, James, can you tell me why you've nominated the Battle of Britain for this list of greatest battles of the Second World War?
Yeah, because it's one of the big moments. I mean, if Britain had been defeated in 1940, it's game over. It's only because Britain holds out in 1940 that Hitler is forced to turn to the Soviet Union early, because he can't afford to fight a war on two fronts. He knows that America is waiting in the wings, that Britain is still holding out. And obviously, the invasion of the Soviet Union is an absolute catastrophe for Nazi Germany. And that's all because Hitler doesn't win against Britain in the summer of 1940. So that is why the Battle of Britain is one of the great turning points of the greatest conflict that's ever befallen the world.
That's great. And then I thought you could give us a bit of context. What's the situation in the months leading up to the Battle of Britain? What's going on in the wider war? What's Germany's position? Let's set the scene a little bit.
The war begins on the 1st of September 1939 when Germany invades Poland. Britain and France have said that if Germany invades Poland, they're going to declare war. And so they do 2 days later on the 3rd of September. And then it's kind of sit back and wait, because the bottom line is that France and Britain aren't really fully prepared for war at this point, and Germany is making no aggressive moves at this time on Britain or France either. So it's kind of what becomes known as the phony war. It's not a phony war at sea, incidentally. There's a kind of, you know, naval battles going on, and the Battle of the River Plate in December 1939, for example, the Royal Navy against the Kriegsmarine of the German Navy. So there's lots going on. The idea from the Western Allies' point of view, from the sort of French and British, is they will mobilise fully, they'll get their armies up to speed, they'll build more aircraft, they'll build more factories, and they'll hold off the Germans. And then at a certain point, when they build up enough strength, then they'll attack again. That's the plan. But Germany attacks first. First up in Norway and Denmark, capturing Denmark and then invading Norway on the same day, on the 9th of April 1940. That prompts quite a lot of consternation, although, again, it's a naval victory for the Allies against the Germans. The Germans prevail on land, you know, very much so. And this is the kind of the foretaste before the Germans make their case yellow, Fallgelb, with an assault on the West, which begins on the 10th of May 1940. And this is with an invasion of the Low Countries and France, And despite the fact that France has a larger army than Germany, and when you combine that with the British Expeditionary Force and the Dutch and the Belgians are all fighting on the same side, massively, overwhelmingly so, much larger armies. Despite this, despite the French having more artillery pieces, more tanks, and a kind of parity in terms of air power, the Germans prevail. And this is because they've got a sort of different way of fighting a war than the French particularly, which are the sort of largest party. And France is defeated in effectively 6 weeks. But actually, realistically, the writing is on the wall in a matter of days. In about 5 days, it's absolutely clear that there's no coming back for France, and therefore no coming back for Belgium or Holland or indeed the British Expeditionary Force. And the result of all this is that the British Expeditionary Force is evacuated from Dunkirk, falls back to Dunkirk on the Channel coast, evacuated between the 26th of May and 4th of June. And it's a catastrophic defeat. But, you know, Britain is able to get most of its army back, if not its equipment, and live to fight another day. And so you've got this then after that, after the fall of France on the 21st of June, 1940, you've then got this kind of sort of slight period of kind of in between time where what's going to happen? You know, is Britain going to kind of succumb to? Is Britain going to fight on? How is Germany going to respond? Are they going to launch an invasion attempt on Britain? You know, what's going to happen? And this is the kind of waiting time. And, you know, it's never entirely quiet, but the official Battle of Britain begins in the second week of July, 1940.
And what was Germany's primary objective here with this aerial attack on Britain? How did it sit as part of Hitler's wider plans?
Yeah, so what Hitler's trying to do is subdue the West. He wants to get Britain and France out of the war so that he can turn east. His initial plan is to kind of sort of invade Soviet Union in possibly 1943 or even later in 1944. But what he needs to do first and foremost is get Britain out of the war. He can't afford to be fighting in the West. Hitler is a continentalist. He sees things in terms of land power. And he is very much assuming that with France beaten and with Britain's army beaten, that Britain will sue for peace. And what he fails to understand is that Britain's is an island. It's not a continental power like Germany or indeed France, really. And his senior service is the Royal Navy and burgeoning air power. And its army has always been very, very small. So actually, its army being defeated is not quite the kind of catastrophe that it might be if you were Germany. And actually, there's a lot in Britain's favour, you know, access to the world's oceans, access to the world's supplies, world's largest empire, et cetera, the world's largest navy at the time, world's largest merchant fleet, access to around 80% of the world's merchant shipping. All of these are very much in Britain's favour. And there's absolutely no reason whatsoever why Britain would sue for peace at this stage. And Hitler's just misread it. But he is obviously desperate to get Britain out of the war because he also knows that hovering in the shadows across the Atlantic is the United States of America, who's made it clear, although is neutral at this stage, has made it very, very clear which side morally it is on. And the United States is very much coming down in favor of the Western democracies rather than totalitarian states like Nazi Germany or fascist Italy.
And what was their strategy going into this aerial attack of Britain? What was the aim for the Luftwaffe?
Well, it was pretty woolly, to be perfectly honest. I mean, the idea was to sit back and wait for Britain to sue for peace, which they don't do. You know, I think with the fall of France, you know, Germany just to see, you know, most Germans think the war is won and it's all over and that it's, you know, Britain's clearly going to sue for peace too, because why wouldn't you? Because you've just lost your army. As I say, you know, not understanding the kind of sort of wider context of Britain's situation. And Hitler returns to Berlin, has this sort of triumphant return to Berlin at the beginning of July. And, you know, millions of people sort of cheering in the streets. It's like a sort of old triumph of ancient Rome or something. Then he doesn't know what to do. You know, he retires to the Burghof, which is his country house in southern Bavaria near Berchtesgaden, which is sort of a stone's throw from Salzburg in Austria. And he sits there waiting for something to happen. Then he issues a speech saying, you know, giving the sort of the British the last chance to kind of, you know, come to terms on the 19th of July. And then he settles down and watches the Bayreuth Wagner Festival. And all this time, they're kind of sort of thinking, well, what do we do? And most of the time he's in the Burghof, you know, he's saying, OK, so let's get the Navy in and see what they'd say. And they say, well, mein Führer, you know, what I really think we do is we need to kind of attack on a very narrow front somewhere between kind of sort of Deal and Ramsgate in Kent. But clearly we need to invade. And then he gets in the army and they say, well, what do you think you should, you know, what do you think we should do about Britain? Well, clearly, mein Führer, what we should do is invade. Let's invade on a very wide front of about 90 miles all the way from Lyme Regis to Deal. And he thinks, okay, maybe. And then he says to the Luftwaffe, you know, what do you think we should do? And Goering says, well, we're just going to smash the RAF and destroy them and take it from there. You know, so you've got these absolutely no joined up thinking whatsoever. And it's absolutely clear that there is no coordinated plan because they've never expected to get themselves in this situation. All their planning has been focused on Fall Gelb, Case Yellow, the invasion of the Low Countries and France. And they hasn't occurred to them that in 6 weeks they're going to win in such emphatic time. So they're kind of sort of thinking, okay, what now? So to start off with, they're making threats to Britain. They're kind of thinking loosely about an invasion, what that might look like. They've got these completely different plans. The Navy and the Army and the Air Force, the German Air Force and Navy and Army are all thinking completely different ways. There's no, as I say, no joined up thinking. There's no combined services planning team or anything like that. But what they are going to do is they're going to certainly threaten Britain and they're going to attack Britain from the air. But of course, this all takes time because you've got to get all your Luftwaffe fighter units and bomber units up into the northwest coast of France. And obviously, fighter planes are very short. You know, they're single engine. They're small, so they've got small fuel tanks, which means they can't go very far. So you want to get them as close to the Channel coast as you can. So suddenly, you know, the Pas-de-Calais area around Calais becomes absolutely thick with airfields, but these airfields have to be created out of nothing. You've then got to bring up supplies and spares and workshops and ground crew and all the rest. And obviously all this takes time. But as they start moving up, what they do is they start attacking British convoys, coastal convoys. So this is moving coal and local supplies up and down the East Coast and through the Channel and all the rest of it from London to Southampton, beyond and so on. So they start threatening that and trying to draw up the RAF, in particular RAF Fighter Command. Not that the Germans have any understanding how the RAF is organised, by the way, and sort of testing the water. But, you know, it's absolutely clear there is no plan whatsoever. And suddenly they need to create one, and they need to create one in pretty quick order.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
One thing I'm really curious about is how did the RAF and the Luftwaffe stack up against each other at the start? If you were sort of going to say one of them's got the advantage here, what would you say?
Well, the Luftwaffe have advantage in numbers, but you have to be very, very careful about numbers because there's what you've got. You've got paper numbers, which is actual aircraft you have in your inventory. Then there's ones which are actually at the front and you can use in combat operations. And that's not all of them. So say you've got, I don't know, like 3,500 aircraft. You might only have 1,500 in the middle of July available. Of those, how many of those are actually combat ready on any given day? Well, you can knock off 25% at least because they've been damaged or they've got engine failure or, you know, some other mechanical failure that needs looking into. So you're constantly being whittled down. And that applies to the British as well. But of course, British have got home advantage, which is that they can operate from bases all over the place. They don't need to be crammed into the kind of, you know, the most southeasterly corner, for example, or in the same way that the Luftwaffe fighter planes need to be crammed as closely as possible to the south coast of England and to the kind of southeast coast of England. So you can sort of spread yourself a lot more widely. So there are more, but it is the job of RAF Fighter Command to defend Britain's airspace. It's not the job of Bomber Command or Coastal Command or Training Command. Now, the other thing about it is that one has to understand is that the RAF is divided into commands. So there is a effectively like an air army of bombers. There's an air army of coastal aircraft, you know, which are doing anti-shipping operations and reconnaissance work and so on. And then you've got Fighter Command, which is there, you know, fighter planes to defend the United Kingdom. They're all got their own organisations, their own command structures and so on. Whereas the German system is completely different. They have air fleets, effectively air armies. And in those fleets, you have bombers, dive bombers, fighter planes, reconnaissance planes. You know, you have every different type of plane, but all in that one air fleet. So they're structured in a completely different way. So the Germans have got a number of different planes. So they've got bombers, they've got dive bombers, they've got single engine fighters, they've got two engine fighters, all of which, you know, you can add up, and they're all trying to destroy the RAF in various forms. So the bombers come over and target the airfields and destroy the airfields if they can. You know, the fighters are there to take on British fighters and protect their own bombers. Dive bombers are there to kind of sort of do pinpoint precision targeting by diving very close, which then means you can get closer to your target, which means you can be more accurate in theory. So that's what the Germans have got, whereas defending Britain is just fighter command. On the other hand, RAF has also got aggressive attack aircraft as well in terms of bomber command and indeed in coastal command. So what you usually get is you get sort of, you know, the Luftwaffe could bring to bear kind of, you know, 2,500 planes against, I don't know, 600, 700, whatever it is, of fighter planes on any given day. It's constantly changing all the time. And that's in a way a kind of not really a very accurate comparison. Because obviously that is kind of 3-1, which is kind of what you need. But overall, if you're adding up all the rest of the RAF, then it's kind of, you know, it's pretty much, it's not far off parity. So it depends on how you're kind of structuring it and depends on how you're looking at it. But basically, in terms of against fighter command, the Luftwaffe have superior numbers, but they have a number of disadvantages in being the attack force rather than the defending force.
Of course. And obviously we were on home turf. The RAF had that advantage, as you mentioned.
Yeah, which is a not insignificant advantage, because if you get shot down and you bail out, you can be back in your Spitfire by 4 o'clock that afternoon. Whereas if you're German and you bail out, for you, the war is over. So home advantage is a thing. And also in the evening, a fighter pilot and his squadron can sort of go down to the White Horse and have a couple of pints, and everyone pats them on the backs and tells them how, what heroes they are, and buys them free drinks, and they feel good about themselves. Whereas the German fighter pilots, you know, in the Pas-de-Calais, they can go down to the local estaminet or bar or whatever, and you've got a kind of, you know, suspicious looking Frenchman polishing his glass, sort of looking at, who are these interlopers who've just conquered us 3 weeks earlier? And, you know, so the whole experience is completely different. And, you know, morale and all these things, are, you know, they're very, very important.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So the Battle of Britain occurred between 10th of July and 31st of October 1940. So quite a big span here. What were some key moments or turning points in this campaign?
I mean, the first phase is the kind of the July phase. And this is the Channel War, really. This is where the Luftwaffe are arriving slowly but surely into the Pas-de-Calais and into the Normandy area. Fighter planes moving up, bombers moving up into that neck of the woods as well, starting to attack Channel shipping, trying to draw up the RAF while they kind of come up with a plan. In the case of Hitler, waiting for Britain to kind of potentially sue for peace, etc. And are trying to work out what their all-out attack should be. And this is going to be called Adler Angriff, the attack of the Eagles. And the launch date is going to be Adler Tag, you know, Eagle Day. And plans aren't really ready. Hermann Göring, who is the world's first six-star general, Reichsmarschall and commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe, he's not really ready for launching his all-out Adler Angriff, attack of the Eagles, until very end of July, beginning of August. And then he reckons he's going to need about 4 days clear weather. He reckons it's going to take him 3 days to destroy the RAF, but let's have an extra day in the equation for luck and for kind of sort of wiggle room. And then they've got to wait for kind of, you know, those 4 days of weather forecast to look good. And it's not until near the end of the second week of August, 13th of August, that the weather conditions look correct to be able to launch it. So then Eagle Day is launched on the 13th of August. It's a bit of a damp squib, to be perfectly honest. They don't get 3 days of clear weather. They certainly don't get 4 days of clear weather. RAF Fighter Command fights back. Then they get to the hardest day, which is Sunday, the 18th of August. And this is one of the heaviest days of air fighting. Fighter Command loses 33 planes. Luftwaffe loses 67. So, you know, moral victory to Fighter Command, definitely. And the big change really happens on the 24th of August when the Luftwaffe accidentally drops bombs on London. And the whole point in the first part of the phase is not to target civilian targets. It's to very much to destroy RAF airfields. That's the plan from the Luftwaffe point of view. And at the same time, they also withdraw the Stuka force. And Stukas are dive bombers and they're getting absolutely decimated. And one of the things about Stukas is that they have this terrifying scream when they dive, this sort of terrible wail, which is supposed to, you know, is deliberately there to intimidate their enemies. It's very effective. The problem with dive bombers, although they are very much the kind of sort of the poster machine of the Blitzkrieg, this very sort of dynamic form of fighting that the Germans are using. The problem with it is they only work if you've got control of the airspace, because as a Stuka dives down, it gets very, very low, drops its bomb, and then climbs out again. And as it's climbing out, it's so slow, it's almost kind of dropping out of the sky. And if you're awaiting a Spitfire or Hurricane, the RAF fighter planes, then you're a very, very easy target. And what happens is, if you don't have that control of the airspace, then you are going to get hit. Where the Stukas have been successful has been in, you know, in Poland and Denmark and Norway and in parts of France, where the opposition's air response has been pretty poor. But the moment it's good, Stukas get stuffed. And that's what happens in this case. And so they get withdrawn from the battle. So suddenly that's kind of sort of 400 aircraft that you can't bring to bear anymore, which is a massive tick for the RAF and a massive cross on the part of the Luftwaffe. So what then happens is the following night, RAF Bomber Command on Monday the 26th of August, goes and attacks Berlin and actually hits Berlin four times before the Germans turn on London, which they finally do on Saturday the 7th of September. And this is a big turning point because they abandon their attacks on airfields and concentrate on London thereafter and other cities around the country, but particularly London. And this is the start of what becomes known as the Blitz. And sort of 8 days later, on Sunday the 15th of September, is a culmination of aerial battles over London, which later becomes known as Battle of Britain Day. And in the first big raid on southeast London, which peaks at around sort of midday, there's around 100 aircraft, enemy aircraft, over of which 75 are fighters and 25 are bombers. And the next peak is about 3 p.m. that afternoon, that Sunday, in which there's about 100 bombers and 200 fighter planes, against which are brought to bear 335 Spitfires and Hurricanes. So when the Luftwaffe are attacking, they're absolutely not attacking with a 3-to-1 advantage. And I think it's really, really important to understand, if you are one of 12 in your squadron and you're attacking a formation of 300, the odds look absolutely overwhelming. But overall, because squadrons are spread out, they're not massed together in one big airfield, they're spread out all over the place, you're never attacking as 335, for example, as the total of numbers that are brought to bear on Sunday the 15th of September, for example. You are one of 12. But obviously it's the job of the historian to kind of take a step back, and it's the job of the air commanders to take a step back and see that bigger picture. And the approach is very much to kind of sort of keep just pecking at the Luftwaffe formations all the time. And the Germans, in a way, kind of do an own goal, because when they're attacking airfields, it's not considered that you need a huge amount of bombers to destroy an airfield. In fact, they're wrong about that, because most of these airfields are at least kind of 100 acres in size, and, you know, they're grass, so they're not concrete runways or anything like that. They're just grass airfields. And actually, you need a heck of a lot of ordnance to be able to destroy these airfields. And although the airfields have hangars and control rooms and all the rest of it, they've already anticipated this. And so there are control rooms set away, you know, a couple, 3 miles away from the airfield, which can continue if the one at the airfield is knocked out. So it's very, very hard for the Luftwaffe to knock out these airfields. And knocking out airfields is really important, because if you knock out the airfield, then obviously the planes can't take off. And also you want to be able to destroy the aircraft on the ground before they actually come up into the air. But because the RAF has got the world's first fully coordinated air defence system, they can see when the Luftwaffe are coming, and so they can make sure that they're not on the ground when the Luftwaffe attack. The other thing is that, you know, it might need 10 or 15 bombers to go and attack a particular airfield, which means you can send over 100 bombers and they can then split up and go and attack different airfields all at the same time. So you're kind of swamping the air defence system of Britain. But if you're going all out for London, it's very clear that you've suddenly got this big mass formation of 300 planes, of which 100 are bombers and 200 are fighter planes, and you can see exactly where they're going. So from a defensive point of view, it's much easier to anticipate early what the enemy's intentions are and therefore plan for those intentions and organise yourself. And that's why on Sunday the 15th of September, you're able to bring to bear 335 aircraft all against this one formation, albeit in groups of kind of 12 or 24.
I was going to ask you, when they shifted their strategy to focus on London in the Blitz, in some ways then this was a bit of a mistake. They should have carried on attacking the RAF targets.
It makes no sense at all. I mean, the truth of the matter is, if you're a kind of, you know, a British citizen and you live in Kent, you live in Canterbury, and you're looking up at the sky and you see these huge formations of bombers coming over, you're thinking, holy moly, that's enormous. How on earth can we possibly defend ourselves against that? But actually, it's very, very, very small beer. The Germans just do not have enough. Now, obviously, try telling that someone whose house has been bombed and they won't agree with you. But compare that to kind of, I don't know, 3,500 heavy bombers which destroy Hamburg at the end of July 1943. You'll realise, it's starting to realise that to kind of create the kind of levels of damage and destruction that you need to be decisive, you need a heck of a lot more than the Germans have actually got. And they just don't have enough to be able to A, destroy the RAF, or B, knock Britain out of the war by just, you know, sheer weight of bombs. They just don't have enough to do that job. And so their whole strategy is gone up in flames. And the truth is that the Luftwaffe has grown up organically since the middle of the 1930s, primarily to support ground operations. And that is what we would later term tactical air force. So it is an air force which is there to support ground operations, as opposed to a strategic air force, which is an air force that operates independently of ground operations and just does its own thing. So RAF Bomber Command, for example, is a strategic air force because it's just Bomber Command. It's just all on its own. It's got nothing to do with the troops on the ground. It's just doing its own thing. That's a strategic air force. What the Luftwaffe has to do from the Battle of Britain is transform itself from being a tactical air force, offering close air support to ground troops, to one that is a strategic air force doing its own thing, operating independently. And it's simply not designed for that, and it doesn't have the scale for that. The other problem is that the Germans, their intelligence on the RAF before the battle starts is really, really poor. The study Blue, which comes out in the kind of middle of July, and this is put together by a chap called Colonel Beppo Schmidt. And Schmidt is a good Nazi, and he is a comparatively, in the big scheme of things, junior intelligence man, but he's also on Goering's staff. And study Blue is very much telling Goering what he wants to hear rather than what the reality is. And of course, if you're attacking, having false information about your enemy's strength or supposed weaknesses is not very helpful. You really want unadulterated truth, and Goering never gets that. And so his whole plan, the whole Luftwaffe plan, is based on a series of assumptions which are just completely bogus. That the Hurricane single-engine fighter that the RAF has is inferior to the Messerschmitt 110 twin-engine aircraft. Well, it isn't. That they have no concept of the different commands in the RAF. They have no idea what planes are on what airfield. They have no understanding of how the air defence system of Great Britain works and operates. Just no idea at all. They don't understand that there's the observer corps, that there's a radar chain, that there's systems in place by which vast amounts of information can be absorbed and disseminated and sent back out again in incredibly quick order. I mean, you know, millions of pieces of information can be handled in a 24-hour period. That they have no idea that there's ground controllers directing British fighter planes to the bombers and to the Luftwaffe as they're coming over. They have no concept that they're being picked up beforehand as they're assembling over France, for example. All of these are huge disadvantages. They're massive intelligence failings, and they're huge advantages for the RAF. And so the whole premise of the Luftwaffe attack is built on a series of assumptions which are just simply don't prove to be the case.
Vastly underestimating them.
Yes, and basically if you're attacking, it's not particularly good sense to underestimate the strength of your enemy.
What sort of men made up the RAF? The men, you know, Winston Churchill described them as the few. Who were the few? And then I suppose as well, who were the many behind the few?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. And we refer to the few as very much in terms of RAF Fighter Command, you know, those dashing young men in their Spitfires and Hurricanes. But actually, it also includes Coastal Command and Bomber Command, because just as the Luftwaffe are coming over and bombing our airfields and over here in the UK, Bomber Command is going and hammering Luftwaffe airfields in northern France at the same time. And in actual fact, you know, fighter airfields, the German fighter airfields in northwest France in the Pas-de-Calais region, two men are having to be kept behind every single day to protect the airfields. So they're taking off to go and attack England, but two of them have got to stay behind to do air defence of the airfield, in case RAF Bomber Command comes over, for example, or in case Coastal Command comes over and does coastal raids or whatever. So when you're talking about the few, I think it's really, really important to understand that it's not just the Spitfire and Hurricane pilots, it's also the wider RAF. And of course, the RAF can only kind of stay in place by the many, as you point out. And the many are the kind of, you know, the ground crew, the civilian repair units, the WAFs in the control rooms and fighter control rooms.
Were women, did they play a role in the Battle of Britain?
Women absolutely do play a role in the Battle of Britain, yes, as officers on the ground and on airfields and clerks and so on, but also in headquarters. And how it's organised is so that you have fighter command headquarters at Bentley Priory. You then have group headquarters, so the whole of Britain is divided into groups. So, you know, 11 group, for example, is London, the southeast of England. 12 group is kind of East Anglia and kind of, you know, Midlands and so on. And each of those groups has control rooms and sector stations and so on. And each one of those in these control rooms has officers, ground controllers, but it also has WAFs who are moving plots on a big map. So the ground controllers would be on a kind of sort of dais looking down on a kind of table map, and the map would be a southeast England, and the WAFs would be moving little plots which would say number of bombers and enemy formations and the direction they're being moved in. And this is being updated all the time as radar information is coming in from the radar chains, but also from the observer corps as well. And they're updating it all the time. And then opposite, on the opposite wall, you'd have lists of all the squadrons available, what state of readiness they were at, whether they were, you know, enemy sighted, whether they're on the ground, whether they're taking off, whatever. It would have details of cloud base. So the ground controller can see at a glance exactly where his own fighter planes are, where the enemy planes are in the channel or over Kent or whatever. And at a glance, he can see the status of his own aircraft. And he can also communicate by headphones, by radio telegraphy. He can communicate with the pilots up in the air. So he can say, you know, go on a bearing of, I don't know, 170. You should be seeing any minute now, you should see a formation of, you know, 50 plus bandits, i.e. enemy aircraft. You know, it's all incredibly, incredibly clear. All the language they use, the code words are all words. They're chosen because they're very hard to kind of be interpreted as anything other than the words they are. There's certain words which sound similar, so you don't want anything like that because there's lots of static involved in those days. So you don't have the sort of lovely clarity that you and I are enjoying today, Rachel. So, you know, it's really, really been very, very carefully and properly thought through. WAFs play a really important role. The Women's Auxiliary Air Force, there's lots of them, and they play an absolutely key role in deciphering ciphers, cipher clerks, and, you know, operations rooms and all sorts of stuff.
And how did the Battle of Britain come to an end? At what point did the Germans decide, right, this is enough, we're going to have to get out of here?
Yeah, it never really kind of, it sort of peters out. So obviously, if you're going to do a cross-channel invasion, you need to have really, really good weather. And, you know, you need clear seas and you need long days. So obviously, as the summer recedes and it gets closer to winter, the days start to shorten, you know, weather gets worse. Chances of making successful crossing over the English Channel becomes less and less and less. It's officially kind of called off in the first week of October 1940. But actually, we consider the Battle of Britain to continue until the, you know, 31st of October. But actually, there's still day fighting going on well into November 1940, and obviously the Blitz keeps going until May 1941, becomes increasingly clear that there's going to be no cross-channel invasion, and that's absolutely crystal clear before the end of September, really.
And I suppose as we get to the end of this episode, what are some common myths we have about the Battle of Britain? We might have touched on a few already, but what are some of the biggest myths that we maintain today about it?
Well, I think the big thing is that it's an incredibly close-run thing, and we kind of got, you know, Britain got through it by the skin of its teeth. You know, the sort of the myth of the few, and it's all that kind of sort of backs to the wall kind of amateurs against the kind of automaton Germans. I don't think anything could be further from the truth. The truth of the matter is that the Germans were incredibly disorganized. You know, from a strategic point of view, they didn't really know what they were trying to do. From an operational point of view, they weren't prepared for it. From a tactical point of view, tactics were all over the place, constantly being changed. And, you know, you've got in the Messerschmitt 109E, which is a single engine fighter plane, they've got the unquestionably the best fighter plane of the day in the summer of 1940. It could, because it can do the three things that you need to do in air to air combat by 1940, which is it can climb very fast, it can dive very fast, and it packs a massive punch in terms of ammunition and firepower once it's in a combat zone. You know, it can out climb a Spitfire, and it can certainly outfire a Spitfire. So, you know, that is the most superior plane. And it's, you know, it's incredibly quick. Can fly at kind of in excess of 360 miles an hour, which is very fast for 1940. But Goering constantly changing the tactics. And so, you know, he then decides in the middle of the battle that he wants close air support of the bombers. Well, you know, bombers are flying at kind of 200 miles an hour and a Messerschmitt can fly at 360. You know, you're just making it kind of operate with one hand tied behind its back effectively. So there's lots of problems. The other problem is they can't keep up with the production. So aircraft production in Germany is starting to really, really lag by the second half of 1940. And to put this in some comparison, in July 1940, Britain produces 496 single-engine aircraft in that 1 month, Spitfires and Hurricanes. In that same month, the Luftwaffe only produced 240, so less than 50% of the production that the RAF are producing. And that's before you get into kind of repaired aircraft and all the rest of it, which again, the RAF is vastly superior. So what you see during the Battle of Britain is, despite Fighter Command's losses, you see the graph going steadily upwards in terms of fighter plane numbers. So that by, you know, the end of October, Fighter Command has got sort of high 700s in terms of numbers, whereas in July, when the battle begins, it's got 600 and something, like 640 or something like that. Whereas single-engine fighter planes for the Luftwaffe has gone from 700 and something down to about 200. So they're really struggling. And what that means is your pilots, the German pilots, are having to fly way more than they should. Because what happens is that each of their squadrons, their Staffel, as they're known, are under strength in terms of aircraft. And what that means is the old hands tend to fly more, because if you're a fighter ace in the Luftwaffe, what you don't want is, you don't want some new sprog who's just turned up and a bit wet behind the ears flying your precious Messerschmitt. So you think, well, I'll fly again. So the new boys aren't flying very much. The veterans are flying too much. And they're flying, you know, up to 7 sorties a day. Well, that's just too much. The absolute top amount of flights that a RAF fighter pilot would be expected to fly is 4, more reasonably 2, and mostly no more than 1 a day. You know, and that flight is sort of maximum of 90 minutes, probably. Whereas, you know, 7 times a day, the mental and physical strain of that is absolutely enormous. And the other problem for the Messerschmitts is, once they come over to Britain, they haven't got very much time in the combat zone, perhaps 10 minutes before they've got to turn back for home. And there is absolute fear that they're going to end up in the Channel, which looks like a river from 25,000 feet, but looks like a largest ocean available when you're on bobbing around in the water. And that starts to take its toll on the German pilots in a very, very, very big way.
Sure, not very good for morale. A lot of people describe the Battle of Britain as the RAF's finest hour. What's your take on that assessment?
Well, I don't know whether it's its finest hour, but it's I think it is probably its most important hour, because, you know, Britain is looking down the barrel. You know, there's been this heavy defeat of France. Its whole war strategy has been torn to shreds. And it is really, you know, the RAF are not the last line of defence. They're very much the first line of defence of Great Britain, because, you know, if the Germans had tried a cross-channel invasion, they'd have been absolutely slaughtered by the Royal Navy without any shadow of doubt. And I suspect they'd have also been fairly slaughtered, even if they had managed to get a foot ashore, by the army. The point is before you can even consider an invasion, you need to have control of the skies. And the Luftwaffe do not get close. I mean, it is this idea that it's a close-run thing, just going back to myths. I mean, it absolutely wasn't. The RAF absolutely walloped the Luftwaffe. It was a catastrophic defeat for them. And one arguably from which they never kind of, you know, properly recovered. I mean, certainly by the time they launch Operation Barbarossa in June 1941, which is the invasion of the Soviet Union, they've got less aircraft to start that battle with, that offensive with, than they did on the 10th of May 1940, when they invaded France and the Low Countries for a much, much bigger objective. So, you know, that's not good. And that's largely because of the wear and tear that the Luftwaffe have been under since 10th of May 1940, but not least in the Battle of Britain, and not least in, you know, in maintaining the Blitz throughout the winter of 1940 into 1941. So it absolutely wasn't a close run thing. The Germans didn't come anywhere near to winning, despite the numbers of planes that people were seeing flying over British airspace and the number of aerial battles that people were watching and so on and so forth. It's just, the Luftwaffe were a long way further off from actually winning than sometimes the history suggests.
Interesting. And my final question is going to be an interesting one then, because you're saying that they were so far off winning. What would have happened if it had gone the other way, if the Germans had succeeded in their plans? If we were imagining an alternate history, what would the impact of that be?
Well, the only way that, you know, had they destroyed the RAF very quickly, then they probably would have tried to launch an invasion. They wouldn't have got very far because, as I say, the Royal Navy was the world's largest, and just, you know, the plans for Operation Sea Lion, as it was called, was so awful and so underprepared. I mean, you think about the jeopardy of Normandy and D-Day in 1944, and that's where we have total command of the skies, total command of the seas, overwhelming forces, and we've won the intelligence war as well. And we've got 4,127 landing craft for D-Day. Well, you consider that for the Germans, you know, they're sort of, you know, they're taking Rhine River barges. They haven't got any purpose-built assault craft whatsoever, really, apart from a kind of few little square ferries, which don't really count. Absolutely couldn't cope with any kind of rough weather whatsoever. I mean, it's absolutely hopeless. So I can't see any circumstances in which they could have got across. There is a circumstance in which Britain sues for peace, and that comes on Monday, the 27th of May, 1940, but that's before the Battle of Britain, and that's where there's an internal split in the War Cabinet, where Churchill, who's only 17 days into the job as Prime Minister, has an argument with his Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, who at the time is the most respected man in Britain, certainly the most respected politician. And Halifax is talking about peace feelers, and Churchill saying, absolutely no way, Jose, you know, if you do that, you open the door ajar, it becomes blown wide open, and then there's no way back. And Halifax threatens to resign over this argument. And had he done so, I think it may well have brought down the government, and that could have been it. But fortunately, Churchill talks him out of it. Halifax doesn't resign. Things pick up a little bit in the evacuation of Dunkirk, and, you know, it's all peachy and it all works out for the best. But I don't think there's any point where the Luftwaffe is getting close to winning. What it would have looked like, I mean, just say if Britain was defeated, then, you know, there'd be a government in exile in Canada, and it would have been a very, very long and awful, much harder war than it actually proved to be.
And then my very final question to you was just, what was the impact on civilians? Obviously we had the Blitz, but what was the impact for people living in Britain?
Yeah, I think there was sort of a combination of kind of excitement, of terror. I mean, what you see is there's real panic in Britain at the beginning of June 1940 when France is falling. BEF, as the British Expeditionary Force, has been brought back from Dunkirk. There is kind of, you know, rabbits in headlights kind of moments. And you can see everyone kind of panicking, thinking that this is the end. And then very quickly, when no invasion comes in kind of, you know, the second half of June or even the second half of, you know, into July, people start to sort of calm down because you get used to the kind of new normal. The new normal is this sort of mad, crazy situation where you're in a war and France has been defeated. You know, the incomprehensible suddenly, you know, you start to digest it. And then I think there is a kind of strain of defiance, which is embodied by those Churchillian speeches of 1940, the whole kind of sort of, you know, we'll fight them on the beaches, we'll never surrender, all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, one has to remember that kind of, you know, 60%+ of the population is listening to those speeches and what a profound effect that has. And then I think there's a kind of sort of a general belief that Britain is not going to lose and that it's all going to be okay. And so it proves to be.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave our episode on the Battle of Britain. Thank you so much, James.
That was James Holland. James is a military historian and the author of several books on the Second World War, including The Battle of Britain, 5 Months That Changed History. He's also the co-founder of the Chalk History Festival, of which we are a media partner. The festival runs from the 24th to the 30th of June this year, and you can find out more about the programme of history talks and events, including plenty on the Second World War, at chalkfestival.com.